Coming to you live from the Culture Hall, this is the Mormon News Report for the week of November 6, 2017. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
Insert some joke about snark here. Brian will fix it in editing and all that stuff, right?
Billy Brandt, I mean, you're not even going to make an effort this week? Come on.
It's been a long week, Brian. They're not all going to be winners, so let's set the standard low, all right?
Hey, no, I'm not going to set the standard low, Brian, because you know what is going to be a winner? This show that we have today. Author Stephen Carter is going to be joining us to discuss his new anthology, Moth and Rust, Mormon Encounters with Death, published by Signature Books.
Okay, so you're going to, I know what the theme of the show is going to be. The theme of the show is going to be psych Brandt up a little bit because, frankly, it's just been an awful week. All right, so let's talk a little bit about this book before we get into it. It's this great little book that's one that you can kind of keep next to your bed and you can like read a chapter a night. And there's 46 of them in there. It's nice. It's really good. And it's a quick read, except it's about death, which isn't always the bad thing, but sometimes it can be. But it can sometimes be funny. And I don't know, Brian, did you have the same feelings that I did about the book? Kind of,
Yeah, well, no, I mean, there's a wide variety of themes in there. And, you know, there's, like you said, there's some funny stuff. There's some really tragic stuff. It's kind of all over the board, but I really liked it. It kind of reminded me of like, I don't know, like an NPR podcast series or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's very true. Like, it's something like you'd expect to hear on like almost like This American Life with a bunch of these little vignettes. Although I will tell you this, Brian, I'm totally going after Steven because he legitimately made me cry with one of the essays that he included in that book. And I literally threw the book across the room and said, that's it. I'm done.
Oh, we need to bring that up.
So I'm going to have to.
We need to bring that up when he comes out.
Yeah. Which is to say, it's a good book, but it's about death. Yeah. But it's a good book. Yeah.
So speaking about death and being done, you know, just scrolling through Facebook today has been depressing. You know, we had this shooting the day before Halloween at the University of Utah, which broke my heart because I just thought about all those poor kids the next day for trick-or-treating, just terrified to go outside. And now this morning, we had the shooting in Texas at a church during services, and 27 people dead. So, I mean, it's just not been a cheerful day.
So, I don't know. There's this part of me that says, oh, but we're not going to talk about guns now.
I mean,
right?
No, we're not.
Even though all this stuff is going on.
Yeah, we're not going to politicize this. I mean, I think, you know, we do get into political topics in this show. And it's tough because you see all these people saying, well, is it time to start talking about this? Is it time to start talking about this? And then the other side saying, don't politicize this, don't politicize this. And we kind of feel like there's some mixed messages, right? It's like, if it's an act of terrorism, then, you know, we can't act quickly enough. But if it's somebody who's got mental health issues or whatever, then it's not time to talk about it. It's just time for thoughts and prayers. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, Brant. I'm just heartsick.
So let me pull one Mormon connection out of it, at least what's happening with the guns, right? I think the more important thing that's happening with the guns, and I think the thing that is very symptomatic of what's going on right now in the United States is the fact that we can't have rational discussions. And Brian, you and I, and not to get too meta with everybody, but you and I, when we first started this podcast, one of the things that we wanted to do was we wanted to have rational discussions about Mormon-related news topics because we felt that that was a need that was out there in the entire Mormon community. There are so many people who are taking any news story and just running with it. And really, what I would hope to do is not so much politicize what's going on with the guns and the shootings, because what happened in Texas, I'm sitting in church, I'm sitting in my own LDS ward here in Detroit, and I'm getting updates on what's going on there. And it's like, what is going on with all this stuff? And that's not to include the car that went over the bike path in New York City and everything that happened there. It's been awful. And I don't know, maybe in some small way, we could kind of be one of the standard bearers for rational discussions on these topics. And Brian, you and I don't agree on everything. I think we see pretty closely on a few things, but we disagree on a lot of things. And I think the fact that we can continue to have that rational discussion is what needs to happen. But Brian, the other thing that today, we're recording this on Sunday, November 5th, this is the 2-year anniversary of the exclusionary policy that the church introduced in 2015. Right. And I'm sure you saw the same thing on Facebook, Brian. It's on Facebook, it's on Twitter, it's on the Mormon Blogger Knackle. This is still a really raw and fresh wound for a lot of people. It's not going away anytime soon.
And both you and I know a lot of people who decided to cut their ties with the church over this. It's yep. heartbreaking. And again, it's another one of those things that I just don't really have an answer for. There was a blog that I read earlier today, and I'm going to feel bad because I can't remember who wrote the blog or where it was, but I was just, you know, skimming through all of these things. But one of the things that it talked about in there is it said, you know, obviously we don't have the ability to make changes at the higher level of the church. And so this blog post wasn't going to be about questioning their decision making or questioning any of that stuff. It was just more about what can we do? And the bottom line was, is we can love everybody. We can mourn with those who mourn. We can try to be an inclusive people as far as those in our immediate circles. That's what we can do. And we can pray. You know, I don't want to give this that sappy thoughts and prayers answer, but Brant, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like that's all I can do.
I get you. And what we're going to get into the news, everybody, but because this is an important day and a day that means a lot for a lot of people, I think we need to talk about it a little bit. I've mentioned before on different interviews and podcasts that I've done that when I first found out about the policy, I didn't want to go to church on that Sunday. I really didn't. I was that yeah. upset. I was that hurt by everything. And I woke up that morning and I said, nope, I'm going to go, because even though it really hurts for me and even though it's really hard, I don't know who else might be dealing with something like this. I don't know how difficult it might be for them. And my thought was, if anything, they could see me and they'll have someone to come talk to, or they'll have someone to sit next to them or something like that. So I went, and I was serving in a bishopric at this time. I was a ward clerk. Credit to my wonderful bishopric. They let me just rant and get it all out. And I think, and I don't know, maybe it was the right place, maybe it wasn't, but I actually said, look, I don't really feel that this policy is very Christ-like at all. And credit to my bishopric who listened to me. And I actually had quite a few people who in the ward who knew me on Facebook and kind of know my views on a lot of things came up to me and legitimately asked me, I know that policy was really hard for you. How are you feeling? I'm someone who my skin in the game is I have a lot of friends who are LGBT. And so I was feeling their pain almost on the periphery or almost as a proxy through them. I can't even imagine what it was like for them. And so the fact that it's still really raw and real, I don't want to be corny and say, remember the 5th of November, but at least within the online Mormon community, the 5th of November, I think is going to be a day that we are always going to remember because there is so much hurt there. So Brian, I think for our purposes, we just want to acknowledge that, you know, this is the 2-year anniversary of the exclusionary policy. We don't have any news stories about it, but it's still something out there.
Right? We know that there's a lot of people out there who are hurt by this and who continue to feel that hurt. And we hear you. I think that's about all I can say.
Yep.
But Brant, I mean, this is, what a depressing Absolutely. Way to start this show, Brant. I need to be cheered up. So did we get any
emails? I was going to say, did you get anything that could pump us up a little bit?
Did we get any emails or anything this week that we can talk about?
Okay, so the question that I had thrown out there, we did a question of the week regarding the missionary changes. We really didn't get any feedback about that, but we did get feedback about former politicians who've gone on to serve in the LDS church. So one of the people that sent us a message was Andrew Hall. Andrew mentioned Gordon H. Smith. Does that name sound familiar at all to you, Brian?
No, it doesn't sound familiar to me.
Okay. The story is going to sound familiar. So Gordon Smith was a Republican senator from Oregon who apparently Oregon actually had Republican senators at some point. That's a shock to me. He became an Area Authority 70 in 2012. He served in the U.S. Senate from 1996 until 2008. Now, he was the one who made headlines when a video was leaked of a presentation that he made to church leaders, where the person who introduced him, Ralph Hardy, described Gordon H. Smith's non-Mormon staff as, and this is one of the most irritating phrases I've ever heard, he described them as church broke. Yeah. And Smith said,
that's not a Mormon thing, by the way. That's an across-the-board Christian thing.
It's not even a Christian thing. That same concept, we get that same concept where I work. You know, if you're going to get to a certain point, you've got to be a certain way, and you've got to, they got to know that they can count on you and that you're going to do what you're supposed to, et cetera, right? Here's where Smith actually made a lot of headlines. Gordon Smith said in this leaked video, he supported the war in Iraq because I felt the Lord's hand in it, believing that the conflict eventually could open the Middle East to Mormon missionaries. So that,
I heard that from so many more, you know, conservative leaning members of the church. And every time I heard it, I wanted to throw up a little bit,
Okay. Not to go on too much of a diatribe, but Brian, I made a joke on Facebook like that Ken Burns guy. I think he's going somewhere, right? Ashley and I have started to watch the Ken Burns documentary on the Vietnam War. And it is so amazing to the two of us to watch this and to see, I wouldn't say it's explicitly graphic, but it's war. And Ken does a good job of showing war. I hear people say what Gordon Smith said, and it's like, guys, you almost need to go watch this documentary. You need to understand this is not, it's not a quick and easy, pleasant thing that happens when you have war.
Right, right. Well, yeah. And obviously we have such a strong and thriving church presence in Vietnam after that war now, right?
Yeah, yeah, anyway. Of course. So the other one that was sent in, this is from Curtis Cahoon. I hope I'm pronouncing your last name right. It's from Curtis, okay? Curtis mentioned Larry Echohawk, and I think we've heard a lot about Larry recently. So Larry was an Obama administration appointee in 2009 as the United States Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Indian Affairs, and he was also the Attorney General in the state of Idaho. So Larry is a member of the Pawnee Nation, and he was named a member of the First Quorum of the 70 in 2012, and he currently serves as an Assistant Executive Director of the Church's Correlation Department. So, okay, we've got a couple of politicians who've gone on, but Brian, I think to your point when we first talked about this, I guess it's not that common that politicians go on to serve in high-profile church callings. So maybe Jeff Flake and maybe Mitt Romney, we need to, you know, just back the truck up just a little bit on them becoming the next general authority,
including me. Well, and make sure they have darn good home teachers so they don't go inactive.
Of course. I mean, you can't have that happening, right?
Anyway, why don't we get on with the news for the week?
All right. Brian, this Stranger Things thing, you've heard about it, right?
Oh man, I watched it all in 2 days, Brandt. It was
did you make it all the way through?
I made it all the way through. My daughter watched it all in one sitting. I was just like, oh my gosh. But yeah,
we had to spread it out two episodes a night. I think the downside of doing that, this isn't too many spoilers, but the downside of doing that is when we finally hit the last episode, I wouldn't say it was a letdown, but everything was crescendoing up to that point. And then because we had ended that night's viewing the day before the last episode, it's like, oh, okay, that's it. I don't know. I'd recommend the last three episodes, watch them boom, 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 right in a row, because they're really, really good. Okay, so everyone loves Stranger Things. Apparently, Stranger Things are really big among the Mormons right now. And Brian, wouldn't you know it, there's a Mormon reference. So we are going to talk just a very, very brief bit of Stranger Things spoilers. Here's your warning. We're going to give you 5 seconds to fast forward or stop listening. Okay. All right, here we go. It's season 2, episode 6. Max is talking to Lucas at her door, whom her brother does not want her talking to. Max is probably about a 12, 13-year-old girl. Lucas is a 12 to 13, and I think it's important to note because it plays a factor a little bit in the TV show. Max is a 12 to 13-year-old white girl. Lucas is about a 12 to 13-year-old black boy. They're talking at her door. Her older brother, who's about 18, is a big jerk and has told her that she shouldn't be hanging out with him. And I think they actually made allusions to his type or something.
I think he said that type of person or something.
There you go. That type.
Yeah.
Okay, so she takes a while, dramatic music, he walks up to the door, she comes back in, and let's pick it up in the middle of the action.
The hell are you talking to?
Mormons?
Mormons?
Talkative ones.
Okay, so boom, a Mormon reference, right? I love this from the Deseret News. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has been referenced many times throughout the history of TV and sitcoms. Shows such as Golden Girls, Friends, and Gilmore Girls all reference the church's members in one way or another, according to the Deseret News.
That's it?
That's it.
That's the story.
That is the story, yes. The Deseret News ran a story on their website to show everyone that the Mormons were talked about in Stranger Things, and then included the fact that the Mormons were referenced many times throughout the history of TV. That's it. Welcome to Silly Town, everybody. This is what we do here.
We're so desperate for attention, Brent. I mean, really, come on.
They talked about us.
You know, and in reality, you know, as we heard in the clip, it could have been any proselyting religion inserted in there, right? They could have put the Jehovah's Witnesses in there, but no, the Mormons are mentioned, so therefore we're gonna make a big to-do out of it because we're relevant, Brant. Anyway,
guys, they're taking us seriously. Oh, they're talking about us, it's 2017. I think people are pretty well versed right now in the Mormons, although I think it was kind of funny. But
it was fun. It was a delightful little thing in there. But hey, let's move on.
Okay, so we're going to stay in Silly Town, okay? And this time we're going to go to Payson, Utah. This is the home of my wife's alma mater, and there's a bit of controversy brewing in Payson, Brian. I think we need to watch out for this. You don't want to mess with the farmers in Payson, okay? They can be quite biting. All right, headline from the Salt Lake Tribune. Payson Junior High accused of exposing children to pornography by showing the musical Oklahoma.
Wait, what?
You heard right. Pornography in the musical Oklahoma, the play, not the state.
No, okay. I've seen Oklahoma the play. It was performed when I was in high school or junior high or whatever. I mean, it's pornography. I don't know. Right.
I'm in the same boat. And not only that, but it's been played and performed for decades, since like the 1950s when it first came out. Okay, so here's what happened. It's a very brief scene in the 1999 film Oklahoma, which has, I think it was performed on stage and they recorded it and they put it on PBS or whatever. So this was generating complaints against the Nebo School District after the movie was shown to students at Payson Junior High School in September. In the film, Hugh Jackman is shown looking at a collection of erotic images while the camera closes in over his shoulder. She's plumb, stark, naked as a jaybird, Jackman's character remarks before the camera zooms out and the scene continues. The movie was shown to students in violation of Nebo School District's media policy, according to spokeswoman Lana Hiskey. Films shown in their entirety must be approved by the school's principal, Hiskey said, and reviewed by the teacher. So, okay, this is kind of hard to do over the podcast, but okay, let me give you a play-by-play of what's going on here. You do see Hugh Jackman looking at these pictures, but due to the lens flare or the glare from the lighting or whatever, you can't really see much of anything. I mean, if you do, you got to look really hard, but most appear to be obscured or blurred. And we're going to link to this scene in the show notes so you can see for yourself if you want. Brian, I like to go on the Internet Movie Database. They've got a bunch of information there about movie ratings, but they also have what's called a content guide. So if you want to know what a movie is going to be included, for example, I get a little weary when there becomes some gratuitous violence. Okay. You can go there and see, and doesn't matter what the rating is. It'll tell you, okay, it's got some weird stuff in there. Like, there's a lot of smoking in here, or there's a lot of sex, or there's X amount of F words or S words, whatever you want to say. So I went to this parents guide to see what they say about this 1999 version of the film Oklahoma. A content guide on their website describes the scene as containing no complete nakedness. So if we go back to spokeswoman Hiskey, she said the parents of one student raised the incident with the district. Administrators have reviewed the media policy with the teacher, she said, and phone calls were made to any parent whose email addresses resulted in sending errors. So they sent an email out to everyone saying, guys, I'm sorry we did this. And then they followed up with phone calls if they couldn't email.
Hey, hold on a second here. So just to once again reiterate, camera pans over Hugh Jackman's shoulder. Due to the angle and the lighting, it's really difficult to make out what's on the page as far as full frontal nudity, and people are flipping out over this.
Right. Like, I don't think you can see details. You can see some stuff, but to sit there.
So you know what this reminds me of? You know what this reminds me of is recently BYU did an edited version of, I think it was one of the Jane Austen films. It was like either Sense and Sensibility or, you know, one of those films.
Yeah, I know where you're going.
Right. And they had, you know, there was cleavage being shown in the dresses, that the Victorian style dresses, mm-hmm. French style dresses that they were wearing. And they decided to blur out the cleavage.
Or even put a almost like a chastity cover over something.
Right. It's like a non-cleavage fade out, right? But the problem is that it really exacerbated the problem because it actually made them all look topless.
Mm-hmm. Like, wait a minute. I thought they were more conservative back then. What's going on here?
Right. Anyway, as detracting from the story, but that's the picture that just came in my mind.
So you're going to love this part then. Information about the screening appeared on several Payson and Utah education-related Facebook groups this week, criticizing the district's response and urging community members to attend next week's school board meeting. Quote, a pornographic movie was shown in a classroom setting to approximately 125 students. Among other things, the movie contained an 8-second close-up of 10 full frontal images of 10 naked women, the post read, not naming the movie as Oklahoma. The Facebook post appeared to originate from Catherine Foster Bolton, who could not be reached for comment. Her post has since been deleted. Brian,
about clickbait.
This is like, Look, I know we kind of get on Utah culture a lot, okay? Well, let me rephrase that. We get on Mormon culture a lot, and because so many Mormons in Utah, it becomes Utah culture sometimes. This is crazy town, right? Like, I don't think anyone could sit there in their rational mind and go, wow, that school district really screwed up there.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't showing a pornography, right? So, you know, maybe whoever decided to use this film kind of forgot about that one little 8-second scene or whatever, you know, whatever it was. But it wasn't like they were like, hey, let's show our kids a porno. It's Oklahoma, for crying out loud.
And, gosh, and this is, look, I know a lot of people have a lot of fondness about the 1850s and the Wild West. I don't know if a lot of people have done a lot of research what the 1850s and the Wild West was like. I mean, this was frankly tame based on some of the stories that I've heard about what life was like, especially when it came to sex and the rough and tumble cowboys and women and stuff like that. It's like, this is, I mean, you could say it's historically accurate to an extent, but come on, what are we doing with this stuff?
Yeah. Anyway, let's leave Crazy Town. What do we got next?
All right. So, Brian, we've talked a little bit in the past about how the church and church leaders and the Mormon newsroom are starting to make more and more statements about some current event things that are going on. So this was a very interesting article from the Salt Lake Tribune. And it doesn't surprise me because of what he said, but it does surprise me for a lot of – I think you're going to know where I'm going with this in just a second. D. Todd Christofferson spoke at the 73rd Annual Assembly of the Inter-American Press Association, and he was speaking to a group of Latin journalists. He had about 300 of them there. This is what he said. Your privilege and calling as a journalist is to facilitate discussion and debate between people who have different beliefs, races, nationalities, and political opinions. An informed citizenry, it's often said, is the bulwark of democracy. The basic principles of journalistic integrity, objectivity in reporting, detachment from personal bias, and disinterested duty to the truth are essential in facilitating public trust and civil discourse. All individuals and institutions, including churches, share an interest in contributing to these worthy goals.
But in the meantime, we have Deseret News. So,
kidding. That was cool. That was you.
I'm kidding, guys. It's actually Deseret News. I actually think does do a fair job of allowing opinion pieces to come on there and having, heck, the Deseret News asked Trump to step down from his candidacy, right? So we rag on Deseret News, but it's mostly out of love.
They're okay. They're okay. Let me put it this way, Brian. The Deseret News, I view the Deseret News as I know what it is when I pick it up, but every once in a while they pleasantly surprise me. As a matter of fact, that piece that we talked about a couple weeks ago on patriotism versus nationalism, I shared that with about three people based on some stuff that was going on in my own personal circles this week. I shared that. And if you would have told me, Brant, you're sharing an opinion piece from the Deseret News, if you'd told me that 3 years ago, I wouldn't have believed you. But they pleasantly surprise me sometimes. However, I'm reading this and I'm saying, I like where you're going with it. It's very rational. I think we can get behind this. I'm comfortable saying this is a good thing, right?
So tell me where you're going with this.
Okay. It's kind of like what we talked about when we talked about the some of the statements the church has been making about some of the hurricanes and things like that and the shootings. They're making more statements. That's a good thing because I think there's a lot of times people want the church to make these statements, but I have to be the cynical Eeyore in this situation and say, based on the current climate of the press and covering the United States government, a lot of people are comfortable with the fact that, yes, the press needs to do their job. But what if he was making this statement during a Republican regime? A traditional Republican regime, let me put it that way. Would people be feeling the same way? What if he were to be saying this during the Mitt Romney regime? And maybe the press was a little hard on Mitt Romney because, I don't know, he's the president and the press does this kind of stuff. Would we be feeling differently? So it's a good thing that he's doing it, but I'm also sitting here going, this is where I have to be cynical. We all need to brace ourselves because at some point they're going to make a public comment on something that's going on. For example, maybe the amicus brief. I know a lot of people got upset with that. We tried to break that one down, and it might tick some people off because it's not what they want to hear.
So are you saying that because of our current political climate and that there's obviously a lot of hostility being lobbed at the press and back and forth between the press and our current administration, that getting up and making a statement kind of like this is a little bit on the safe side right now?
Yeah. And yes, I would. And I would also add to that, this is what we want in the sense of what we want being you and I, Brian. We want them to be making statements like this so we could take it, analyze it, and contextualize it. And I wonder if we could just take a flamethrower to the Mormon internet, except for all you on the Mormon internet that we actually, you know, like. if we could take a flamethrower to that place, right? And have us be set up as, okay, this is where we're going to facilitate and show what rational discourse looks like when it comes to analyzing some of these statements or discussing some of these statements, I'd be good with it. But I think the problem is I don't know if we can trust how the internet's going to react to this. And it shouldn't matter how they react, but there's a lot of times they seem to set the pace for, I don't know, how we're going to be discussing it or what the reaction is going to be, because all of a sudden it's, oh, well, they're saying this and I agree with it. So yes, everything is awesome. And of course, I don't have a problem with anything that's going on there, or I can't believe they said this, so let's burn the whole place down. You know what
so,
I mean?
Okay, so I'm deeply appreciative of the statement that Elder Christofferson made, if for no other reason, because it continues to set us apart. I mean, we're still a deeply Republican people as mm-hmm. Mormons, but it continues to separate us from perhaps the more extreme ends of the Republican Party and brings us back into the center, which I think is where mm-hmm. Mormons do really good, is more in the center position of the Republican Party. So I'm all for us maintaining that distinction of saying, yes, we know that that the party right now is full of a lot of turmoil, a lot of chaos. There's a lot of things being lobbed back and forth between the press and between the administration. But you know, we're gonna stay here and we're gonna say, yeah, we have conservative values. We are a traditionally Republican people, but we are not always going to agree with what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm with you on that. And so it's a double-edged sword. But Brian, I will say this completely selfishly. Boy, does this give us some great content, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, it was a thing that came up this week.
You guys go ahead, and LDS Church, you go ahead and you keep making these statements, because Brian, it seems like every week that goes on, we're cutting stories and we're trying to debate, should this not be included? I kind of like that.
You know, at the beginning of every week, I wonder, okay, what are we going to be talking about at the end of the week? And is this going to be a slow news week? Is there going to be, you know, but man, Brian, we've been doing this now for what, 17 episodes?
Yep.
And there hasn't been a week that I don't think there's been a week that's gone by where we're like, oh man, what are we going to have to cut? There's too much going on.
Maybe the week after Thanksgiving. That'll probably be it.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Maybe that'll be it.
And
all right.
And Brian, I think with the week after Thanksgiving, we're going to get stories like this. Okay. Tell me the headline that we're going to be talking about here.
Oh, I love this one. Right. And partly because I know the historian that they interviewed for this, and he's a great guy, and we'll get into him. But was your ancestor really a bodyguard for the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith?
Okay, so you sent me this, and my first thought was, is this clickbait? This has got to be clickbait. Am I going to be frustrated? Brian, why are we talking about this?
No, give it a chance, Brent.
Okay, here we go. A recent flash.vote poll posted on the IMLDS Facebook page, which obviously, I mean, it's about as scientific as the polls that I do, guys, asked people if they've ever been told an ancestor was a bodyguard for Joseph Smith. One of the more than 425 people who voted, 53% said yes.
Yeah. So like over 200 and what, 12 people said yes.
I mean, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people.
Joseph Smith didn't live that long, guys.
Okay, even with the idea that a lot of these people could be related, right, because of polygamy and all this kind of stuff, you're still like, you know, close to 200 people.
Well, and all right, let me give you all a forewarning that this is going to be a completely tasteless joke. If y'all were bodyguards for him, you did a pretty crappy job.
Ouch.
So I'm just going to throw that out there.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay. So, Brian, I think this is right for us to, you know, do our thing. Okay. So let's get our nerd on. Okay. Jeffrey D. Mahas. Okay. Jeffrey D. Mahas is a historian for the Joseph Smith Papers Project. And this is probably the one you know, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We literally sat next to each other for a couple of years while we did our internships there.
See, I mean, how much more of a personal connection do you need than that? That's the kind of stuff.
And he also has a chapter in the recent Council of 50 book that we interviewed Matt Groh and Eric Smith about a month or so ago. Yeah. So read his chapter. It's fascinating.
Here's what he said to the Deseret News. And I think when I read this first paragraph, I was like, okay, Brian, I get where you're going with this, and I'm totally on board. For starters, the term bodyguard was not used in that era, although there is at least one instance where the prophet anointed men as his lifeguards. I think this is a claim that's really common, but if you go back, look at Joseph's journals and financial records. You are not going to find people listing out a calling or occupation as bodyguard. I think a lot of the claims of being a bodyguard have come from participation in several different organizations that existed during Joseph Smith's lifetime.
So,
and Brian, go ahead.
So when he said lifeguards, the first thing that came into my mind was that whole discouragement that we have against swimming, right? That was the in the Missouri. Right. And so
running on the pool deck. No running.
Exactly. So Joseph Smith was a lousy swimmer. He had 200 and some odd lifeguards.
Yeah. So here was the thing that shocked me the most. All right. So I'm reading that going, oh, wow, a rational take. Okay. So we're not going to be feeding into some of the. Okay. All right, show me what you got. All right. Brian, the Deseret News brought up the Danites. Pick your jaw up off the floor and let me repeat that one more time. The Deseret News brought up the Danites, and apparently
we can talk about it.
This is the permission that we needed. We can officially talk about it. We're good now, right?
Yeah, we can officially discuss it.
Okay, so here's what he said. The Danites, for everyone who isn't aware, was a group that was created back in around the late 1830s. The group's mission was to defend the Mormons and their property against Missouri mobs and former church members.
I'm going to correct your history there for a little bit. The group's mission was actually to root out dissenters from within.
Okay, so here's the important thing. The definition that I'm reading is according to an article on LDS.org, and I think, Brian, if I remember, that article created quite a bit of stir. So let me just go through what the LDS.org says, and I think I need you to fact check this, okay? Sure. The group's mission was to defend Mormons and their property against Missouri mobs and former church members who had turned hostile. So that's what LDS.org said. And
the former church members who had turned hostile. That was the initial intent of the Danites. But yes, of course, because of what was happening in Missouri, they were going to be defending against property and all that stuff as well.
So here's what Jeffrey said. We don't have a list of names for the Danites. We know from sources that one of the chief purposes of the Danites was to defend the first presidency. Again, it's conceivable it gets passed down in the family lore as it was my mission, my job to defend Joseph, especially when the Missouri War breaks out and you have to start fighting. So, Brian, this is one of those stories where, I don't know, there's a part of me that wonders if I've said before, both of my parents are converts, so I'm a second generation Mormon. I don't have connections to Joseph Smith. I don't have pioneer stories, okay? Brian, it's been my experience that there's a lot of people who have connections to pioneer stories. They've got to have some juicy bit of family folklore that's being passed down. For example, your great, 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 great Uncle Smith's brother, his wife, her father, he was a bodyguard for Joseph Smith. I've got to imagine that that's pretty common, right?
Yeah, yeah. It does make me wonder, though, how many of these were actually just the Danites, right? Or part of the Nauvoo Legion or some sort of an official organization that just got passed down as being one of Smith's bodyguards.
It wouldn't surprise me at all, especially with everything that went on with the Danites and a lot of the, how would I describe it? A lot of the feeling and sentiment that was going on around them at that time, especially their feelings towards Joseph and towards the Mormons in general, especially with all the, basically they felt that it was their duty to defend them against anybody that might be considered hostile to the Mormons. And so,
including Mormons themselves who were hostile.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yep. But Brian, you were telling me that the Community of Christ has some folklore that kind of fits into all this. Is that right?
I don't know about kind of loosely fits into all this, but it also shows how the term Danites has been somewhat caricaturized later on. So just like half of LDS people believe that their ancestors were Joseph Smith's bodyguards, Community of Christ, you talk to them, and about half of them believe that their ancestors were people who actually did come to Utah, but then bailed out in about 1856. That would be about the time of the Mormon Reformation that Brigham Young was doing. That was a pretty intense period in Utah that was including things like rebaptism for loyalty and really just, putting a lot of pressure on people to up their game, so to speak, when it came to their personal lifestyle and loyalty to the church. But at any rate, so the common folklore for a lot of Community of Christ members is that their ancestors bailed out in the middle of the night quietly and were so afraid of being murdered by the Danites that they would wrap their wagon wheels with blankets to quiet the noise as they would head back to the Midwest. So it's fascinating. Now, we have no historical record that shows that the Danites continued to be a thing post-Missouri. In fact, what it looks like is that the Danites morphed into an official militia, which is the Nauvoo Legion. And the Nauvoo Legion did get reconstituted or reinstated in 1856 or 1857 as soon as we heard that the United States Army was sent to subdue Utah. So the and we called it the Nauvoo Legion again. We didn't call it the Utah Legion. We called it the Nauvoo Legion. So it's conceivable that that it was members of the Nauvoo Legion that they were afraid of.
And so you got my brain working now. We're going to go ahead, everyone, we're going to go ahead and do some show planning on the air, okay? So just bear with me on this. Brian, I think at some point what we need to do is we need to do a top 10 years in Mormon history because I had completely forgotten about the 1856 Mormon Reformation that was happening in Utah at the time. That is a fascinating time. And yeah, I think we should do a top 10. Yeah. So put that in the back of your mind. Anyone, if you've got suggestions on what years would go into this, let us know because this is something that we got to get into because I don't know if that many people know about what was going on in 1856? What was going on in like the 1890s with everything going on with polygamy? What was going on in like 1912, 1905 during the Reed-Smoot hearings? There's some great years in Mormon history that I don't think people know because we tend to focus on the ones we all, you know about and we can recite. But there's some other ones we got to do that. But Brian, I think what you were going with this and I'd be fascinated to know people's stories. I got to know. Do you have, and we're going to throw this out to anyone, you could mail us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com. You could hit us up on Facebook or on Twitter. Do you have a pioneer ancestor story? And I don't want to hear the normal ones. I want to hear one of the crazier stories that's passed around your family's folklore. The crazier, the better, and they got to be somewhat real. Like, I don't want you to make something up. I want you to tell me something that you might hear at Thanksgiving. For example, was your ancestor one of Joseph Smith's bodyguards? What about Brigham Young's bodyguard? I want to know your favorite around the table Thanksgiving pioneer folklore, because this stuff is good. You almost can't make this up.
All right, let's move into our last story for this segment.
So this one just happened like literally a day or two ago before we're recording this. The LDS Church made a $10 million donation to construct housing for the homeless in Salt Lake City. Brian, you're looking for a cherry on the top of this crap Sunday that has been this week. I think this is a good one.
Yeah, this warms your heart.
It does. The LDS Church announced it will give $10 million to Shelter the Homeless, a nonprofit organization in Utah. This makes more than $52 million the church has donated over the past decade to nine groups that serve the homeless in Salt Lake City, according to the Deseret News. This is in response to a massive effort in the Salt Lake Valley to remake Utah's response to homelessness. Now, Brian, I know you're not in Salt Lake proper, but you are in Utah. From what I'm seeing in newspapers and things like that, the whole homelessness problem in all of Utah, especially if you're along the I-15 corridor, that's something that everybody's talking about right now, right?
Yeah, yeah. You definitely see it. It's definitely a problem. But you still have all of these negative Nancys out there that are on the face webs saying that the only reason that the LDS Church is doing this is because they're trying to make Temple Square look pretty for all the tourists and potential converts to the LDS Church who visit Utah each year. Knock it off, guys. Knock it off.
Okay, hold on. Okay. I want to acknowledge the good that happens, okay? At the same time, I think there might be a nugget of truth in what they're saying. Because I think the church does have a vested interest in making sure that every place around Temple Square looks good. And you know what? For Temple Square itself, it is their prerogative to do so. That being said, I do think from everything that I've read that homelessness, especially around Salt Lake City, is a very big problem. And so if that's what it takes for them to do a very good charitable thing here, then great. I'm good with that because it's legitimately helping people. I will say this too. $52 million the church has donated over the past decade to 9 different groups that serve the homeless in Salt Lake City. That should be commended. That's a very, very good thing that's going on.
Yeah. So, I mean, my response when people say, well, they're just doing this to try to just, you know, make us look good, right? To, you know, for visitors and whatnot. My response to that is, well, then should we not do it?
Brian, I think that's the thing. Like, if you want to sit there and say this is the sole reason for them doing it, I would not agree if someone were to say, well, Brant, the only reason that they're doing this is because they just want to make Temple Square look good. Because I would sit there and go, I flatly disagree with you. If you've never interacted at all with LDS Charities or LDS Humanities, the humanitarian group, if you've never interacted with them, then you are completely and disturbingly ignorant for the good, the legitimate good that they do. But at the same time, if there is this periphery benefit that goes on there, I don't think that they would be upset by that.
I don't have anything else to say to that.
Okay. So I guess we're good. We'll be right back with Stephen Carter. Have you ever been listening to an interview and get frustrated because just as they're getting to the good stuff, they end it? Are you the type of person who wants to be on the cutting edge of breaking Mormon news? Did your doctor recommend you increase your snark quotient every day as part of a well-balanced Mormon diet? Do you feel a moral imperative to support independent Mormon journalism and the Mormon News Report podcast? Then consider becoming a Patreon member to the Mormon News Report podcast. For just $1 or more per month, you can get access to our entire back catalog of Mormon News Report podcasts. Want to know what we thought of the 2017 October General Conference? It's in there. Want to know about that one Brant rant that had you scratching your head wondering, where is he going with this? It's in there too. As a Patreon subscriber to the Mormon News Report podcast, you also get a special podcast link to the Mormon News Report extended sessions where we roll up our sleeves and get intimate with our interview guests. And we always leave a choice insider nugget for your support. Your generous contribution helps us to produce the best in Mormon news with just a sprinkling of snark. So consider becoming a Mormon News Report Patreon subscriber today. Just go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com, and search for Mormon News Report, or go to patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a subscriber today. We'd like to welcome onto the show Stephen Carter. Stephen is the editor of Sunstone Magazine and collaborator with artist Jet Atwood for the graphic novel series Eye Plates. He is also the author of Mormonism for Beginners and a collection of personal essays titled What of the Night. Today we're going to be discussing his newest work, Moth and Rust, Mormon Encounters with Death, published by Signature Books. Stephen, it is darn good to have you. Thanks for coming on tonight.
Yeah, it's nice to be around such handsome people.
Oh, you are too flattering.
Facebook radio.
That's the reason why we haven't done video yet, everybody, is because we've got radio and all that stuff.
Our subscriber numbers would just plummet if we were to put ourselves on camera. I guarantee it.
It's very true. So, Stephen, I got your book in the mail, and I will tell everyone this. The book might surprise you a little bit because it's not as big as most traditional books, and I actually loved the size of it because it fit perfectly on my bedroom nightstand table, and it was quick and easy to pick up. But when I saw the
also
title,
the back of the toilet, it fits very well in the back of the
toilet. Yes. Let's not forget that. Or a nice windowsill next to the toilet. If we all want to get a little personal with each other, but, the byline for your book, Mormon Encounters with Death, it reminds me of that line from Davy Jones in Pirates of the Caribbean 2, where he goes, "Do you fear death, Jack Sparrow?" So let me ask you, do Mormons have a unique or even a weird relationship with death?
You know, I've been thinking about that, as you might expect, and kind of the answer I came up with is that Mormons are particularly unskillful when it comes to interfacing with death. It's almost as if we'd want to deny it altogether. For example, when you go to a Mormon funeral, what's the big focus?
The potatoes.
The focus is the end. Oh, yeah, the potatoes, of course. Besides the potatoes. But the way that a Mormon funeral usually goes is some reminiscences, but The bishop is there. He starts the meeting. There's a prayer. There's a song. It all follows the Mormon format. And then at the end, the bishop gets up and he gives us a little sermon about the plan of salvation and lets us know that everything is in God's hands. Things are going exactly as they should be. Let us adjourn to the funeral, potatoes. So when we come to this point where we are in the middle of death, when someone has in fact died among us, we go to excruciating extent to say through the meeting that we hold, through its very structure, everything's fine, folks. Nothing to see here. Do not look at the man behind the curtain. And so we put so much work into not going into the mystery of death. I say in my introduction that this would seem to be a very boring book because Mormons think that we know everything about death. But as far as I can tell, that isn't the case. We do have a story that tells us what death is, where it goes, and what's on the other side, and what its purpose is. And that pretty much takes over every conversation that we have about death. And I wanted to open that conversation.
So Stephen, I think that you've set this up well to talk about just the general theme and purpose of your book, because I think that by reading the title alone, particularly the subtitle, Mormon Encounters with Death, that a person could assume that this is going to be a book of near-death experience encounters, which is very...
Dang, that was exactly what we were not going for. We went through so many subtitles.
I know. Well, but it's but when we talk about encounters with death, I mean, that's kind of the first thing that popped in my mind. And it's, you know, and also because that's a genre that is so darn popular among Mormons.
It is popular. No, this is much more quotidian than that. We have a few things kind of like that, but really what I was after was kind of the Mormon funeral that I've always wanted to go to, which is a funeral where people bring their authentic selves and respond authentically to the death that has occurred near them. Instead of telling us the plan of salvation and how everything's okay, responding to it with honesty, with confusion, perhaps with some hope. So yeah, it's much more quotidian than that. And gosh, you just made me feel terrible. We worked so hard on that.
Let me
subtitle,
give you,
isn't it?
No,
no, that's all right. Maybe it'll drive up sales.
Let me give you a virtual hug here, Stephen. It's gonna be hard. I feel better.
Okay.
So let me, Stephen, let me ask you, because you brought up the Mormon funeral, or I don't know if it's a Mormon, but the funeral that you want to see, and you also brought up the story of the bishop who gets up, and it's in a sense it's almost formulaic. You know, you get people that get up, there's a few reminiscences and this, and then some authority needs to get up and say, all right, everybody, I understand what's going on, but let me put it all in perspective and tell you why you shouldn't feel bad or why you shouldn't be sad. Because I think in your introduction, you called it, death is just a teeny weeny part of the plan of salvation. And it's annoyingly to those who lack an eternal perspective that they have to remind you of that. So, okay, so if I don't want to armchair quarterback do a psychology thing on the Mormon people in general, but I know that for us, we like to talk about how death isn't a bad thing because they're going to a better place. And I think for some people, it helps them to be able to say, okay, it's not bad because they're going someplace else, so I shouldn't be sad. Do you think that's a good thing? It sounds good on paper that we're doing that. We're helping people to go through the grieving process to maybe find some light in a very dark and sad time. But is it good in practice?
Well, it's efficient in practice. It gives us a way to say, okay, we went through the grieving process. Whew. All right. Everybody get back to your callings, get back to your testimonies. We've got a sacrament meeting to do on Sunday.
Nothing to see here. We've moved on. So check that box and see you next time.
No, see the problem with the way that the Mormons encounter death, and I have to admit this may be a general problem, is that we tend to to skip what I call the second act. So in storytelling, the first act is when the problem is set up. The second act is when you are struggling with the problem. And the third act is when you overcome the problem. So if you go to a Mormon testimony meeting or to a Mormon Sunday school, you'll notice that when people tell their stories, they'll go first act really quick and then third act with a big long moral at the end. That's how we usually tell our stories. And so the problem with doing that with death is that as much as we want to feel like we've got a hold on death, it really is a gigantic mystery that you need to experience when it comes. It needs to go through you. It needs to bring up whatever it is that your unique soul is going to bring up in order to respond to this gigantic mystery that's just been dropped in your lap. Not having a mother or a father or a child or anything like that. This isn't something that can be dealt with on an assembly line. This is soul work. This is messy work. And as you know, Mormons hate messes. We have a principle for everything and everything in this place.
Everything goes to its proper place, and we are good with that, and everyone's good with that, and we all go from there.
Right.
There was another thing that stood out to me about the book. So I get the book. I notice, first of all, small little things that Stephen, I think you and me and Brian can appreciate. Paper quality was great. Like, I love the paper quality. But the other thing that stood out.
Yeah, and the front cover texture, right? Like Jason Francis designed this.
Oh, yeah, he did
this,
a fantastic job.
And fantastic job. He's one of my favorite designers in book publishing right now.
And so the other thing that stood out, so I'm looking at the book. Okay, it's smaller. Okay, I like the paper. And then I go in, and it's a collection of essays, so I want to see, okay, so who are some of the writers? You had, I think, 46 different essayists that were in there, and Stephen, they're all over the map. You've got people like Richard Dutcher. You've got Geralyn Poole. You've got Eugene England. You've got all these people in there. Ben Washburn. And they're all different styles. You've got some long prose, some short prose. You've got some poems. You've got a bunch of stuff. So
Facebook status comments, right? Like some of those.
And it was
like Geralyn's was like Facebook status size. But then you've got like flash fiction.
And I'll say this.
Eric Samuelson.
This is my big pitch for the book. Yes, death is uncomfortable, but the best part about this book is there are these quick essays and quick writings in there that make it very easy to pick up, read it for about 5-10 minutes, and then just go away and chew on it for a little bit. And I love doing that, especially Stephen. I've got a 3.5-year-old and I've got a 1.5-year-old, so I don't have a lot of time at all.
Right.
So it's nice to be able to get home, crank one of those out, play with them while I'm thinking about it. So the question I have for you is this. This is a really eclectic group. What went into selecting them and their essays?
Part of the help just came from the vast network of writers that I know from being Sunstone's editor for the past nine years. You know, I know a trillion people, and everybody has something to say about death, especially writers. And so I got a few from past issues of Sunstone. I got some from past issues of Dialogue. And as you saw, I got one or two Facebook statuses and said, let's flesh this out just a little bit. And so, I started there, and it just kept on getting bigger and bigger. People just kept responding. It was quite amazing, actually.
So let me go back to the length of the essays themselves. Was that a conscientious choice to make them that small and compactable and easily digestible?
Yeah. The main thing that I wanted out of this book was to make these just as distilled as possible. I wanted them to be just as pure as possible, something that you could, kind of inject straight into your veins instead of having to chew it up, swallow it, digest it, make it all go out. I just wanted it to go straight in into you with a very low bar to entry. So for the most part, these essays and such don't exceed 1,000 words. And that was what I asked of the authors. I said, see if you can get it in under 1,000 words. Give it to us purely as possible.
So earlier in the show, when we were describing the book, I said it kind of reminded me of some of my favorite NPR episodes like This American Life, where they give you these little vignettes and snippets that are all based on around a general theme. And it had that vibe, like I was reading a This American Life, you know, podcast, of course, longer because there's a lot more content in there. But I'll tell you, this past week, I've binged two things. I've binged Stranger Things and I've binged your book. Like I read your book in 2 days, you know, which is about 23 articles per day. And I couldn't get enough of it. It was quite literally a page flipper. And I was, you know, my wife was next to me doing homework and I was like, oh, you got to listen to this. You got to hear this. There's a lot of really great touching moments in there. There's a lot of heartbreaking moments in there as well. I mean, we deal with, you know, when you're dealing with death, it isn't just about people, contemplating their own death. You've got people losing their children in this book and, grieving over that process. You've got people who are on the edge of death and who won't quite let go of life for whatever reason. And their family is saying, you just need to let go. There's some really compelling things in there. I can only imagine for you that this must have been a challenging book to edit.
Yeah. Fortunately, I spread it out over about 2 years, which helped. I could think about other things in between. But you're right. Death was on the mind a lot, but it helped. It helped me, you know, think about it. I don't know if you want to go in into those things. Are you afraid of death, Brandt?
Well, so I was going to wait a little bit longer, but all right, let's get into this. You are officially on my bad list, okay? Okay. The 30 pages in the fleeting section about death of children, Stephen, I'm not kidding you.
You're not going to forgive me for that.
Okay, and you know what's coming. That was the hardest section of any book that I have read in a long, long time, okay? And I think a big part of that, like I said, I've got two kids under the age of four, and I've noticed that now that that's in my life, I used to be able to... like binge watch Law and Order SVU. I literally can't do that anymore, especially when things of children come up. The movie Children of Men, when not to spoil the movie, but there's a part where a very dramatic birth happens. I'm in tears on an airplane looking at my wife going, what the heck's the matter with me? So I'm very sensitive to it now for some reason or another. I read Doug Gibson's story, A Short Life.
Oh, that was a heart wrencher.
Stephen, I threw the book across the room and I was like tears welling up in my eyes and I was so mad. So question number one, it's not a question, it's a demand. You need to explain yourself, okay? And two, why must you make me feel this way? Like, right. This hurts. I don't want to feel this way, but it was one of those things where it's like, this is really, listen, I'm a salty old codger, okay? If you can make me feel this way, you and Doug and everybody in that section of the book did a good job, but I don't want to feel this way. So you need to explain yourself and make me feel better, Stephen.
Hold on. Before we allow you to soothe all of Brant's concerns and pain that you've caused him, let me just throw a little bit of my own pain that you've caused.
Oh, goody. Give me more. I'm starving.
So a couple of things. Like Brant said, you know, so I've got kids, too, and I can't imagine losing any of them. I've got a 13-year-old, an 11-year-old, and then a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. And it's just, you know, as much as they drive me nuts, I can't imagine what life would be like if I lost any of them. And so reading this book, number one, reading those experiences, yeah, was heart-wrenching. Number two, I know, like, half the people in your book.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know Doug Gibson. And, yeah, when I came across the story, I'm like, oh, Doug, I never knew. Like, I mean, that's how I felt with literally half these stories. It's like, oh, I never knew. I'm so sorry. The other thing, too, is that, so I turned 43 years old this year. And I've noticed that as I'm creeping into my mid-40s, like, every day I'm convinced I'm going to die. Or I'm going to get, like...
I shouldn't laugh at that, but it's
funny. Or I'm going to get, like, cancer, right? Like, every day... Like, I'll be driving down the road, you know, going to, like, a work meeting or something, and, you know, like, I'll have my arm up on the side, you know, window, and it'll start maybe going a little bit numb because I've been driving for a long time, and I'll think, okay, this is it. This is it. My arm's going numb. It's going to start tingling. I start talking out loud to make sure that my speech isn't slurring. I'm like, I'm going to have a heart attack. I'm going to have a heart attack right now in the middle of the freeway. I just know it. I am super paranoid about this. So yeah, reading 46 essays that remind me that death is literally standing at the end of my bed, you got some explaining to do.
Well, thank you.
Steven, actually, let me say this. Take that as like the utmost compliments from Brian and I, because the fact that you were able to elicit that much emotion out of the two of us, you and the essayist did something really, really good in this book.
Well, thank you. I will make sure that all of them listen to this podcast and send it to all their friends, because that is quite a compliment. And it's a compliment to Signature Books that the book survived the throw as well.
Mm. Yeah, kind of. I was going to say, binding, yeah. Right? Good binding, guys. This is a throw-worthy book.
And let me just say this really quickly. So just to cover really quickly the different themes that are in the book. So we talked about the death of children. That's in one section. There's also a section on a loved one's death, on the soul after death, on the death of children, on the death in other contexts, like the death of an animal, for instance, and one on how death affected the writers personally. So that's what y'all need to be prepared. It's going to put you through this emotional roller coaster, but Brian, I don't want to answer for you, but for me, it was worth it. I'm not sure how you.
It definitely was. And in all seriousness, I mean, we're kidding you, and you know, I mean, somewhat, but it did move me. But really, like, this is a book that the immediate thing that I started thinking in my mind is, who can I give this to for Christmas?
You're a morbid guy.
I was gonna say, that's a morbid Christmas. Can I absolutely destroy by giving this heart wrenching book and make them contemplate their own mortality? Who do I hate that much? No, I'm joking. No, really though, it's so I gave like David Sedaris's most recent book a couple of years ago, you know, away for Christmas, and I love giving away books that have short vignettes in them, particularly short vignettes that have touching moments, that have humor in it, but also pull at your heartstrings. And so I do honestly think that even though this is a tough subject, I think that your book is a great gift book for those who are maybe a little bit more nuanced in their perspective of life and death.
Yeah, I'd love to see the sales go through the roof. That would be a great Christmas present for me.
Well, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen because of the Mormon News Report.
That's right. So, okay, so we've been talking about some heavy stuff. Steven, we need to get into my favorite essay.
Let's do it.
My favorite essay was from The Woman, The Myth, The Legend, Our Mutual Friend, Geraldine Poole. Her essay was Lowered Expectations. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read it, okay? When I was 8 years old, I was baptized a member of the Mormon Church. Being the oldest of six kids, my parents stressed that I was setting an important example for my brothers and sisters. After I left the baptismal font, my mother met me in the dressing room where she dried my hair and cried tears of pride. She gave me a tiny necklace with a pearl on it, telling me I was perfect in the eyes of Heavenly Father, that if I died at that very moment, I would go straight to the celestial kingdom. She said, I need to remain pure and without sin for the rest of my life. That night, I taught my 7-year-old brother how to flip people off.
Boom. Like, I read that, and I was like, what is
that? Oh, that's so Geraldine.
And it is. And I will say, like, I was reading it, and this was after some pretty heavy stuff, and I was like, oh, that is so good. So let me ask you, what can humor teach us about death? and also, you must have some great stories about working with Geraldine, because I know I do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What can humor teach us about death? That's a really interesting one. See, the thing is, oh man, I'm sorry. I would have to think about that one. I don't have something right. I can answer your previous question, but not that one.
Let's go to the previous question. Can you think about this while you're answering the previous question?
Oh, okay. So I'm supposed to make you feel better for going through that chapter that I totally warned you about in the introduction. I warned you, and yet you read it. It actually used to be worse.
It's your own fault, Brant.
Just to let you know.
I know what it was when I picked it up. I know what it was when I picked it up, so that's my fault.
So to me, that was a really difficult set to put together. And I too have children. I feel the same way about them. And to me, this is the reason why things like this are so important. So the baptismal covenant, as outlined in Alma, tells us that we need to mourn with those who mourn and comfort those who stand in need of comfort. And this isn't so that we can make people feel better. It's because we need to... There's a light side of life and there's a dark side of life. Lehi said it. I'm losing all of my words.
Well, I think I know where you're going with it.
It's really important to go down into these earthy, difficult places with other people. This is where we make our connections with people. We enjoy going to parties with them, bantering with on Facebook with them. We enjoy having podcasts together. But the way that we actually become Zion, to me, the way that we actually communicate with each other, the way that we actually mourn with each other, and see, that's what the covenant says. It says we need to mourn. Mourning is an essential process of our soul making, and so this is kind of a little book of mourning. It's sort of a primer on how Mormons can learn to mourn and therefore come closer together, come closer to God. Because when was it that the Nephites finally started returning to God? It was when they were mourning. So,
well, and even I'll tell you this, and I know we were giving you a hard time about it, but I will tell you, it was one of those things where I was, you know, to go along with more scriptural scriptural references, reading some of that stuff and really being deeply emotionally touched by it. It helped me to learn how to succor those that stood in need of succor. Mm-hmm. So I might not have gone through it, and I'm not saying that these essays are a replacement for going through any of those tragedies, but in essence, I think this is where you're getting to. By really taking you down into some of those places and just exposing yourself raw, I think maybe it helps if I ever knew someone who had to go through a situation like Doug Gibson, where their newborn passed away, or to see someone who saw a loved one pass away in front of them. I've personally never gone through that, and I'm not saying that this is a replacement for it, but at least I can sit there and say, I might know just a smidge of what you're feeling, and I can't imagine what you're going through, but I want to be here with you because I can't imagine what you're feeling. And so I think that's the good thing. It's really nice when we have, stories and there's a nice bow on it and everything's great at the end, but that's not life. And sometimes I think essays like this show you just how messy life can be. And that, like you said, we're all trying to get through this together. And so, yeah, sometimes you have to feel a little bad because it helps you to see just the full spectrum of emotions in life. And that's what I loved about the book.
So just real quick before we wrap up here, going back to the humor question, because there were a couple of humorous essays in this. By and large, it was not a funny book, but, you know, Bent Washburn's was funny. Yeah. Gerilyn Hassel Pools was funny. There's a few other funny ones thrown in. Sometimes people deal with grief through humor. And that isn't downplaying the grief, right? It's not trying to minimize or trying to put away the grief and deal with it in some superficial way because they're using humor. It's because that is their tool to sit down and cry with you, to hug it out with you, and then to get you laughing a little bit. It's that full range of human emotions. Mm-hmm. And humor is part of that. And so that's what I'm seeing in your book, is the full range of human emotions. Mm-hmm. Which includes anger, sadness, morose, fear, humor, all of it's in there.
Yep, because that's all that we get here in this life. I mean, we're promised a great Chuck-O-Rama buffet in the sky, but all of us who are here now, we have to deal with what we've got here. And the only way that we can do that is with each other.
So, Stephen, I think that's the best way to wrap up on this. I will tell you, if I ever have to be involved in a funeral, that is how I'm going to describe it. We are all going to the great Chuck-O-Rama in the sky, and I'm going to credit you for that. But thank you so much for the book. It was great, and I really recommend everyone pick it up. Don't pick it up if you want to feel happy, I'll be honest. But if you really want a strong emotional journey through all the different aspects of death and how we Mormons approach it, I really, really recommend it. Moth and Rust, Mormon Encounters with Death, which is edited by Stephen Carter, can be found at local area Utah bookstores such as Benchmark Books, Written Vision, Weller's, King's English, as well as online through Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, or wherever you buy books. Thanks again for coming on, Stephen, and we'll be right back.
Apologetics can be defined as a defense of faith through argumentation. Christian apologetics comprise some of the earliest forms of Christian writings. Throughout the centuries, apologists have argued for the reality of God, legitimacy of Scripture, the creation, the fall, the preeminence of grace, and the eschatology of the end times. Adding to these, Mormon apologists have defended Joseph Smith's first vision, the embodiment of God, continuing revelation, extra-biblical scripture and temple rituals, among other topics, and have reached new levels of sophistication through training in fields such as history, philosophy, and Near Eastern languages and culture. Through multiple perspectives, the contributors to this volume explore the textures and contours of apologetics, revealing deep ideological fissures within the Mormon studies community concerning its utility. In spite of these deep-seated differences, what each author has in common is a passion for Mormonism and how it is presented and defended. This volume captures that reality and allows readers to encounter the terrain of Mormon apologetics at close range. Learn more about perspectives on Mormon theology, apologetics, by visiting gregcoford.com.
And now for your moment in history, brought to you by our friends at todayinmormonhistory.com. 115 years ago this week, on October 31st, 1902, the following was recorded. This is from Joseph F. Smith and his counselors. Joseph F. Smith, John R. Winder, and Anton H. Lund to John W. Hess on October 31st, 1902. Very old men in whom the tobacco habit may have become a part of their nature and who may regard it as a great hardship to be required to abstain from its use in order to receive your recommendation to the temple, should at least be willing to curtail themselves as much as they possibly can and promise to cleanse themselves from the tobacco odor and not use it at all the days they do work in the temple. As to drunkenness, we certainly think you should draw the line there. You know, Brian, this reminds me of one of my favorite Mormon jokes. I'm going to do this really quickly, okay, everybody? A bishopric goes on a camping trip. It's the bishop, the first counselor, the second counselor, and the executive secretary. They're out camping. They're having a good time. They're around the campfire, and the bishop goes, "Brethren, I'm very sorry. Whenever I go camping, it's a pet sin of mine. I like to smoke a cigarette." So he takes out his, I like to smoke. So he takes out his pipe, puts some tobacco in there, and smokes. The second counselor, or the first counselor, says, "Well, brethren, I would like to admit something as well. Whenever I go camping, my own pet peeve or my pet sin is to make some coffee." So he takes out a thing of coffee and he puts it on the fire to warm it up, and he's going to drink that. The second counselor says, "Brethren, I've got an admission as well. My pet sin of choice whenever I go camping is to drink a little whiskey." And so he takes out a flask, he takes a drink. All three of them turn to the executive secretary, and the executive secretary says, "Well, brethren, I have a pet sin as well. I'm a big gossip."
So basically,
anytime a bishopric asks you to go camping with them, be very careful.
Yeah, yeah. So what I like about the historical story, though, is it's like they're not telling them, "Look, guys, you need to start following the rules." They're saying, "If you can, if you wouldn't mind maybe slowing down on that, curtailing yourself, and please, stop coming into the temple smelling like tobacco."
Now, hold on, Brian. You just hold on right there, because we all know that when Joseph Smith was going to have the surgery on his leg, he turned down the alcohol because he knew about the word of wisdom. You're telling me that the word of wisdom has gone through evolutions and changes?
You mean it had nothing to do with the fact that he was a kid and probably thought that alcohol tasted absolutely disgusting?
The next thing you're going to tell me, that Jesus himself drank grape juice instead of wine.
Yeah.
Come on now. Anyways, and that's our show. We'd like to once again thank Stephen Carter for joining us. If you didn't know, we're part of the Cultural Hall Podcast Network, so make sure you check out the rest of the shows available on theculturalhall.com. Music for today's show was provided by Scott Holmes. Brian Whitney produced and edited today's show.
Hey, and listen, guys, we really appreciate the reviews that we get on iTunes. We like to read them online, so please send in some more, because, you know, this week, you know, we had a couple of responses from the question that we threw out, but we like to read those reviews, too. It makes us feel good, right, Brand? It tells us that we're valued.
Brian, it warms the deep, dark cockles of our heart that haven't seen light for a while, or something like that. And if you'd like to reach out to us directly, you could email us, mail@mormonnewsreport.com. You could check us out on Twitter @TheMormonNews, or look us up on Facebook, Mormon News Report Podcast. We'll be back next week with more news, commentary, and interviews with a sprinkling of snark. Until then, we'll talk to you again after a while.